The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
And then I'm probably clear, too, speaking this way. Not so muffled, so. So, welcome, everyone. Nice to have you here and be together this way. And to be a little bit of a celebration about, you know, the whole pandemic time, to see so many people coming back to IMC this way and coming, sitting in community. And I really appreciate the chance to practice together and be this way. So thank you for being here. So the central feature of this mindfulness practice is attention. And attention is maybe a number of different faculties we have, different capacities we have, that come together under this umbrella term, attention. And I'm aware of, in this modern kind of technologically centered world that many of us live in, there's a fair amount of conversation now about how there's a lot of money and a lot of effort and a lot of intelligence that goes into tricking human beings' attention, capturing people's attention. The more clicks you can do, or the more you'll surf, the more you'll maybe you'll consume, or the more all kinds of things that happen. And so to get people's attention and keep it on their monitor, on their screen, there's a whole industry for it. And many of us participate willingly with that whole enterprise and maybe spend hours a day sometimes on a monitor and sometimes even, you know, caught by the news, caught by the social media, caught by, you know, the advertisements or, you know, searching for something. And there's a feeling among some people who are studying this that it's a problem for our society, that so many people's attentions are captured and being pulled along. And if you go along willingly, it can even feel like you're so free. I can just go along and just anywhere I want to go, I can just go freely into the surfing the web. But in fact, it's not that free, the mind. In a sense, the Buddha 2,500 years ago was addressing the same issue. But what was capturing the mind was not social media, but and monitors, but rather was desire. Desires in the human mind. The desires, in one form or other, would hijack our attention, take it over, or attention would get pulled into sometimes a black hole of desire, of wanting something, or not wanting something, kind of flip side. And from a Buddhist analysis, we don't want to put the responsibility or the blame on those people on the other side of the monitor who are dreaming up all the ways to capture our attention. And from Buddhist point of view, you're responsible for your attention. And certainly, probably there should be a lot of changes in how social media and computers are presented to the world. But still, in Buddhist point of view, we're responsible for it. And probably the same problem as it was in the time of the Buddha, that somehow or other desires or aversions, we're caught in the grip of it and it pushes our attention. Sometimes our attention is held hostage or hijacked by these strong forces of the mind. And as I said earlier, it can feel the same way, that if you can give yourself over to your desires, your aversions so completely that it can feel, I'm so free. It's like given an unlimited credit card to spend. You know, you can feel like so free to go into the shopping mall and just buy everything, you know. And it's too much for you to carry. That's okay because you have a credit card. You can just get Sherpas to carry everything for you, or the equivalent. Buy the robots that are going to kind of follow you around and carry everything back with you. So it's just because you're so free, right? It's so great to be free. When you sit down to meditate, you discover that that kind of mind is not that free. You find that the mind sits down, you want to just do the simple thing of sit down and be present in the present moment, maybe be present for the breathing. And in fact, the mind doesn't want to do that. The mind has a mind of its own. And in a certain way, it's not your mind anymore. It's not the mind that you have some control over, some authority over, some choice over. You get pulled away, pulled away, pulled away. And it's a powerful lesson to meditate, to see that, to see how not free the mind is, whereas we thought we were free the other way. Now you have a choice. One choice is to go back to the old way. You know, and in a sense, when we're on the web, if you have a monitor to look at and the web to be connected to, it's almost like you have unlimited, you know, credit card. You have unlimited, you know, money. You can't buy anything necessarily, but you have just, I think you have unlimited ability. Just go, you know, search, and feel free. But but hopefully when people meditate or in another kind of ways, even just going for a walk in a park or just having a Sabbath day and doing nothing, we start reclaiming our capacity to be at home in ourselves and not have the mind incessantly searching, wanting, doing. But the mind becomes at some profound, meaningful rest and ease. And it's a kind of reclaiming the mind, rediscovering the mind, or the heart if you prefer, or even ourselves. And some people are really out of touch with themselves because of the monitors before, you know, they work on monitors, they spend all their time in monitors, and it's kind of a way of being disconnected. And to reclaim ourselves, to reconnect to ourselves, to find ourselves, discover what freedom means in some deep inner way, where we feel like the mind has become our friend, the mind has become our companion and support for the fullness of our life. So attention then becomes the medium, the means for freedom, because it's how we use attention is a measure of where the freedom and the lack of freedom is. And so attention is mindfulness. And so we're developing this capacity to be mindful for the purposes of this freedom that is a reclaiming of ourselves, of coming back to ourselves and being able to breathe easily again, freely again, and openly. And I don't know, maybe I shouldn't say again, because some of the ways that we, the deeper ways we discover, it's like for the first time that we find this way. So for the cultivation of this attention in our practice, we consider that it's an ecology of the mind or ecology of the heart that's operating, meaning there are different faculties, mental faculties, that are operating, that are cooperating and participating in this endeavor, in this task of setting the awareness free or reclaiming it. And appreciating that there's an ecology, there's all these different pieces of the mind that support attention, and which attention cultivates and develops. And so this, what I'm going to talk about today, the ecology, is something called the five faculties. And the five faculties are five functionings of the mind, five kind of processes of the mind or of our inner life, if the mental world seems too mental, of our inner life, that we're all operating. In fact, they're operating for you right now. It isn't like they're strange, mystical kind of states. To be listening to me, these are operating. And you know, your capacity to be attentive is being tested here as I give a talk, because you're either attentive because you want to be, or because it's so fascinating what I'm saying that you're just captivated and caught. I mean, this story I'm telling and the drama and the you're just waiting at the edge of your seat for the resolution of this fantastic talk, right? And you're just kind of caught. Maybe. Or your mind is drifting off in thought. And your mind is lost. Or maybe you've decided that you're thinking about really good Jeopardy questions, and that's the best use of your time, sitting here, not listening to me, but, you know, coming up with a Jeopardy question. So you've made this choice. This very thing I'm talking about, the ecology of attention, is operating here while you're attentive, while you're living here. And you might want to listen just enough to use to then reflect back, how is it operating for you now? Are any of these factors, how are they living in you now as you're listening? So I'll first kind of just name the five faculties, and then I'll kind of talk about them in different ways, maybe more creatively than just the classic language, how they're described. So most commonly, in English, they're described as faith, energy, or effort, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. And what I want to highlight first is that the importance that here, mindfulness is in the middle. It's the third factor. And the first two factors, faith, whatever faith is, this energy or effort, they're considered to be activating, energizing. Faith is meant to be inspiring, to bring energy. That's the function of faith in this practice. The fourth and fifth, on the other side of the middle, mindfulness, is concentration and wisdom, both of which are supposed to help with a settling, with a freeing, with a relaxing, with a de-stressing. And so they're activating and settling kind of qualities. And it says that mindfulness in the middle helps bring those into balance. As mindfulness develops, these other four qualities can follow in the wake. They get stronger as mindfulness gets stronger. But also it works the other way, that the other four are the foundation that we create, that we bring in, that supports mindfulness. Like a scaffolding we build for have a lighthouse on top, so the lighthouse can see and spread light in all directions. So these four other four, as they become strong, help support and hold up the awareness so it becomes strong and for us as well. So it begins, and so the list begins with the Pali word sadha, which is most commonly in English is translated as faith. I like to think of it as wholeheartedness. What you put your heart into, you know, what we put our heart into doing, what we do wholeheartedly, what our heart wants to do in our life is really important. I don't think if you really ask your heart, what are you going to put do wholeheartedly, put your heart into, because you really love it or it's really meaningful for you, it's probably not going home to your monitor, to your device, and search Amazon for the wonderful things you can buy and what's on sale. That's probably, the desire might want to do that. There's energy there for it. But it's not the whole, if you really tap into the what you want to put your heart into, it's probably not that. What we put our heart in, what we do wholeheartedly, what we put our kind of, our whole self into, what's really valuable, what feeds us and makes the heart sing, what is that? And so that's what I associate with this word, sada, faith. There's some idea that in the centuries before the Buddha, the word sada meant hospitality, which also is a very nice idea, that what you're willing to be a host for, what you're willing to be present for and invite, come here. So what you put yourself into wholeheartedly with your attention, where do you want to put your attention at? What's important for you? And what do you want to be the host for? It kind of goes hand in hand, because the idea in meditation, at least, is to put your attention wholeheartedly to reclaim yourself, to be here for yourself, with yourself, to reclaim this attention. This is important. And then in doing that, be the faith, to have the faith that it's appropriate to be the host, to be hospitable to all things that occur. faith is kind of, since I use the word wholehearted for it, it's the more the emotional, most emotional quality of the five faculties. So there's an emotional quality of inspiration. It's very, that's why it's energizing. We're inspired by this. Wow. I can't do it yet. But if this is what's going to, I'm going to find my freedom, set my attention free, reclaim my attention for myself, that's good. I want to do that. This is important. And then the next one, the effort part, is to put some energy into this. You know, not to have a good idea. Yeah, this is a good idea to be wholeheartedly present. But yeah, I'm going to do this. I'm going to, you know, really give myself to it. So the engagement. The non-conventional idea that I like to associate with this word is to inhabit. To inhabit our aliveness, to inhabit what we're doing. And I like this for myself because then it's more than just a mental thing. You know, meditation, just bring your attention and pay attention and know what's happening. But to inhabit for me is to be embodied, to kind of be present in a fully embodied way. I'm here with this experience. And there's more faculties of attention than just what goes on in the mind. The part of the faculty of attention are all the sense endings, the nerve endings that have for sensations in our body. And they're just as important for embodied, fully developed attention as any capacity of the mind to recognize, oh, that was a sound. If there's a sound outside, for example. There's also the whole embodied sensory apparatus that takes in that sound. We haven't had it for a while, but occasionally it's really great to have these cars drive down to have the really deep bass boombox. Because then it really feels like this is embodied listening. You know, the whole body shaking. And even the building shakes sometimes. And in the ancient language of the Buddha, I don't think he associated with his effort or energy with, you know, really being inhabit your experience. He associated it with courage. So to do something, to do this courageously. And sometimes this practice requires that, to some degree, kind of a little courage. And then I love the idea that courage comes from the French word heart. So that we don't feel like we're striving or, you know, or kind of overriding what's happening, but to really courageously show up for ourselves and feel what's here, be with it. And that's hard sometimes, right? Our emotional lives are difficult and challenging. And so to do this practice. So that's what we put energy into. Then on the other side of mindfulness, there is concentration. And concentration is probably not the best translation for samadhi. Samadhi is often associated with tranquility. It's also associated with letting go. A lot of letting go. Some people. One of the first lessons I had when I went to Thailand to do this practice here, like the first evening I was first there to engage in the practice, I was in a monastery and was talking with some of the monks, and they were a little bit critical of concentration practice, and they were saying, "Oh, that's just about letting go." As if that's nothing, if it's a small thing. But the idea was that to develop deeper states of concentration has more to do about letting go than it is about laser focusing your attention. And so this letting go, and the word that I like to associate with concentration, that's a translation of an ancient teaching, is to be settled. Concentration is to be settled on your experience. And so now you feel how it's the idea of settling, letting go, relaxing, tranquility, how concentration is the calming effect of the five faculties. So we inhabit and engage, we're inspired, but that can be too much sometimes, and then it comes into balance with relaxing, with settling, with letting go. And bringing those into proper balance is the art of mindfulness. If we let go and relax too much, you start falling asleep and the mind wanders off too much. We need the engagement, we need the inspiration, the clarity. And so we're navigating this ecology, inner ecosystem, and figuring out which one to bring forth. And then the fifth one is wisdom, which has a lot to do with having insight, really seeing in the present moment. It's not wisdom that you carry with you. It's like you read a book and now you think you have all the wisdom you need because you have this knowledge. I think the word insight probably works better to translate panya, in the sense that it emphasizes what you're seeing and understanding in the lived experience of the moment. So that's where the wisdom is, in the lived experience. What do I see now? And one of the primary forms of insight, here and now, that this enterprise is about, is to be able to recognize the difference between stress and not stress. The difference between when we are adding stress to our mind, to our body, to our heart, and to know that's a possibility of not adding that stress. Stress is not healthy in the long term. Stress is not where freedom of attention is discovered. We don't reclaim the fullness and the ease of ourselves by being stressed. And so rather than thinking of wisdom as being this complex, you know, you have to get a book on Buddhist philosophy to understand the ins and outs, the depths of, you know, Buddhist wisdom. It's always something very simple what's being discussed here about wisdom, something we can see and know for ourselves. And one of the primary ways to say it in modern, simplistic terms is to be able to have wisdom, insight, to see clearly when what we're doing is stressful, and to know that we don't have to do that. We might not be able to stop it, so don't add stress on top of stress. But to see that, to know that, is to start having wisdom. Oh, I'm striving, I'm pushing, I'm resisting here. All that is stressful. Okay, so now I have to be aware of this, be attentive to that. I have to know that at least. I have wisdom. I don't know what to do about it, but at least I have wisdom about it. Another form of wisdom becomes more and more important as the practice becomes, as the capacity for attention becomes stronger, is to have more and more clarity about how moment by moment, and I want to emphasize that, moment by moment, our experience is constantly changing. And why that is important is then we really see that, then we're willing to kind of maybe surf on it, as opposed to hold it like it's one way. This is the way it has to be. This is one of my delusions has been sometimes, I've arrived. This is how it is supposed to be, you know, in meditation, for example. Okay, finally, I'm concentrated. This is it. Or finally, I feel some sense of calm and relaxed and happy. I've got it made. Don't breathe. You'll mess it up. But really, life is more like being on a surfboard. You finally caught the wave. You don't say, this is it. You have to be very attentive to the changing natures of the wave to be able to stay on the board. Or in a bicycle, maybe that's a better example for some of you than a surfboard, is, you know, you never say, like, now I've got it made on the bicycle. Like, don't move. You know, it's, you know, you're constantly navigating, negotiating, and shifting your weight and adjusting the, you know, everything. So to really start appreciating the intimacy of changing nature of experience here and now, then attention, this whole enterprise of the five faculties, are involved in not fixating on anything, because any fixation is stress. So if the faith is in the forefront, wow, this is so, I'm so inspired by this, or this is what I realize now, what's most important for me and what I'm willing to put my wholehearted attention in. Not necessarily the activities that you do, but rather how you do those activities. And that's the secret of Buddhist practice, I think, is not what you do, but how you do it. That's where this inner freedom is really found. And that's why when we do mindfulness meditation, it's not exactly the meditation that's important. Like, don't think you have to become a great meditator. But rather, it's what you're learning about how you use attention. And as you learn how to use your attention in meditation in this simple laboratory, then it'll start spilling out into your life. And then when you go home to wash your dishes or clean the kitchen floor, it isn't about getting the floor clean as quickly as you possibly can so you can get back on your monitor. It's you discover that you reclaim yourself, your freedom is found in being fully present for washing the kitchen floor as if there's nothing else to do in the whole world. There's no stress about the next thing. There's no stress about, why do I have to do the kitchen floor? You know, didn't I do it last week? You know, someone else should be doing it. These are all ways that interfere with just inhabiting being wholehearted, being relaxed and settled, letting go, not adding stress, seeing where the non-stress is in washing the kitchen floor, being present with attention for this activity. And by the time you finish doing the floor, it's like, well, that was great. Not because the floor is great, not because the particular activity is like the greatest thing invented by human beings, but because of what you brought to it, how you were with it. That's the trick. And that's what happens after a while, the freedom of mindfulness practice is portable into anything that you do, where what you do is less important than how you do it. And it's what you do is important, and you might love doing some things more than others, but the wholeheartedness, the faith, where we inhabit, where we are settled, is in how we are with our attention, how we are present with our attentiveness for what we're doing. So you might consider how there's a way of being wholehearted in the attentiveness you bring to what you do. That's easier to do if you don't equate what you're doing with the attentiveness. Some things are hard to be inspired to do in and of themselves. But what's inspiring is the attentiveness by which you engage with them. Some of you probably have been parents. Some of those things we have to do are not inspiring at all. The things I had to do as a parent, I never would dreamt that I had to do. I remember one day, I shouldn't tell you this, but one of the big surprises was when my kid was really young and he was still sick and he started throwing up, without any horror or any disgust, I just put my hands together and cupped them to receive the vomit. It just seemed like the most natural thing to do. So occasionally, occasionally we have to do things which, you know, are not necessarily something you would think ahead of time wholeheartedly. But it's how we do it that becomes the thing, you know. So to be present for whatever, wholeheartedly, to inhabit it, the energy factor, to discover, to be attentive, to really attend to. I like that the attention kind of means to attend to really attend to with our capacity to be present, to know. To do it in a way that's easeful. I like the word ease, and it's almost a synonym of concentration. To do it with relaxing and ease, letting go. Letting go of what? Letting go of what we learn with our wisdom. Letting go. Wisdom shows us where the stress that we carry. And over time, as the practice develops for us, we see more and more where all the stress lives in our body, in our eyes, in our jaws, in our hands, in our belly, in our minds, in our brains. All these different places. And we learn to not give in to that stress. We learn to relax it. These are five faculties that you have, that whether you know it or not, we're somehow present here listening to this talk. Maybe some of them were in short supply. Maybe they're all present in a wonderful way. But I hope that it at least gives you some idea of what we're, the landscape of what mindfulness is about, kind of the terrain, the map of the different faculties that were coming into play. It might seem like a lot to keep in mind, five different things, but you're using them all the time anyway. And as you've become more aware of this, and first it might be like riding a bicycle, it's awkward, and feels like you're now even more stressed out because you have to keep all these things in mind. But as you keep doing this practice, you'll see these things become stronger and become more second nature. And it becomes, sometimes it becomes like, oh, this one's weak. Or this one's overdone. I think I'm trying too hard here. Or I think I'm, I could use a little bit more inspiration here. What do I feel wholehearted about? What's really important for me? And realizing what that is, does that bring me some more juice to being here attentively, finding my freedom in my attentiveness? So, that's my talk. May the five faculties be a treasure, be five treasures for you that you realize are in you. It can be your wealth. So, thank you. And we have a few minutes before the official ending for the talk. We can maybe take 5 minutes or so if any of you have any comments or questions. And then afterwards, after that, I'll invite all of you, we'll go out in that and continue having a discussion in the parking lot outside. We take the folding chairs out and sit in a big circle, and we can take off our masks out there if you want. And we just have an open discussion. But before we go out, if there's any questions, comments now that any of you would like to ask, here.
Hi, thanks for your talk. So what I've been thinking was, I feel as my practice deepens, I start to notice more things. Maybe when talking to people, we start to notice patterns of thoughts that they have, and they're not like asking for help or anything, but you can tell it seems like a trap somehow. And I still don't know how to navigate that. Like, they're not asking for advice. And is that something that you should, like, tell them so they are aware of? Or?
Oh, I see. So what you're saying is that as you're becoming more mindful and understanding your inner landscape better, you now understand other people better. And you see, for example, that there's, whatever they're doing now, how they're talking or how they're engaging, that they're involved, for example, in a stressful way. And so should you, poke them and say, hey, you.
not that way. But
yeah, yeah, I understand.
Like
I know. I apologize. I wasn't at all implying that you were not at all implying it. You were that's what you meant. But so the first thing that occurs to me is to tell you the story when I was first doing this practice regularly. I saw how people were so caught up in their ego games, you know, and wanted to get, some people wanted to get praised, or back then the language was stroked, and I didn't want to play the games anymore. So I had a girlfriend and a wonderful woman who wasn't a practitioner, and so I didn't want to, you know, play those games. And so the relationship ended. And many years later, what I realized was that I had some wisdom, like seeing how things were operated, and there was some wisdom about not participating in it. But what I lacked was compassion. And so I didn't care for her. I didn't understand her suffering, and didn't understand how I was being was actually, because she wasn't a practitioner, had no idea what was happening, that it actually probably added suffering to her rather than took it away. So you want to be clear if you see something in others, that they're ready to hear it, that they want to hear it, that it's welcomed, almost invited, that it's useful. And you're doing it out of care, and it's the right time to do it. So things like that.
Thank you. That sounds kind of the answer I've been found. I found, like, with compassion, and it's almost like an art form on when and how to do it. So, thank you.
And don't underestimate how valuable it is to be present for people, to listen to people. And, you know, the inner system of human beings shifts and changes towards health when there's a lot of attention. When we give attention to ourselves, this whole thing I'm talking about today of really bringing attentiveness to our life tends to shift and move things towards health. When we bring a lot of listening and a lot of attention, just listen and be present for other people, it tends to move them towards health too. So don't underestimate how useful that is. So even though you might see that person's stressed out, rather than telling them that, offer them the kind of caring, simple, relaxed attention that maybe helps something in them to relax. And then they might learn eventually on their own. They'll recognize. It's a very good question, and I just scratched the surface of all the answers. So there's a question here.
Thank you, Gil. This was an extremely valuable session for me anyway. Along the line of the thread that this gentleman initiated, there are times when people ask for advice, but they really don't want the advice. So I think perhaps part of the wisdom is recognize when there is a room for advice to be given and when there is just simply supporting and actively listening and just being there for them. How do you feel about that?
I didn't quite follow. Let me see. So you're talking about when people ask for advice or when they don't ask for advice?
Well, sometimes they ask for advice, but then you find out later that they really did not want the advice. They just simply...
See, yeah. Well, in Japanese Zen, there's a little saying or instructions or something. When someone asks you a question, and I think they mean then the kind of Dharma question, like with a teacher, but it's maybe good here too, is... only do 30% answer. and then see if they ask again. And like the Buddha sometimes would not answer the first time someone would ask. They have to ask three times. And actually in Zen monasteries, they have that idea. It's kind of built into the ritual of the Dharma talk. You know, no one sees it, but before someone gives a talk, there's some kind of ritual ringing of bells and bowing that's offline sometimes, where it's kind of meant to replicate the idea that the community is asking the person three times to give the talk. So, you know, so just offer just enough that you're responding, but not everything you could say. And then see if they want more. And they'll come back with more, and they'll come back with more.
Thank you.
Great. So, oh, is there a question? Let's do see if there's no question in the chat. Okay, well. So, thank you all very much. And those of you who'd like, we can go outside. And there's a cabinet just around the corner there. You'll see. Some people know where it is. You can take a folding chair, and we'll go out in the parking lot, and we can make a big circle and wherever, and then chat for a while together. Thank you.